Tonight's lecture is on inter-process communication. But before we do that, let's try and remember what we talked about last time. Can somebody give me like 5 minutes on what we talked about last time? What was the topic?
Processes.
What about processes? You can certainly read it back to me, but give me, in your own words, what is a process? Why is this important? Why did we even talk about it? Maybe it's just some sort of weird fetish of mine that I like to talk about processes for no good reason other than it's my fetish. Or is there something perhaps a little bit more concrete behind the motivation to talk about processes? How does the process assist you in that task? What is the job of the process in that task you described? Okay, how does the process do that? What's the mechanism that's being used there that enables the process to do that? Okay, so the process is a representation or includes, it has something to do with the program. But if that's the case, why didn't we just say program? Sorry? It's too simple, right? You can't be an expert if you just talk in simple words. You have to have complex words. But there's actually something else that we had talked about. Why can't I just say, oh, process equals program? So that's the question. And we're leading up to one of my favorite pet peeves, so.
There we go.
A process is not a program because if you have just a program, you cannot execute it. There are other things that need to be assigned to that program in order for it to be executed. There are other resources. Right? So a process is in fact a bag of resources. Or a resource bag. Among the resources in that bag are the program. Is the program, I suppose I should say. So from that point of view, the process is not a program. A program is part of a process, but a process is not a program. And confusing program for process is my pet peeve. You should not do that. And when I say favorite pet peeve, I of course mean the pet peeve I hate the most. A process is not a program, and saying program when you mean process is one of the prime indicators that you don't know what you're talking about. So that's one of the things I key on when I hear somebody do that. So a process is a collection of resources that enable the associated program to execute usefully. Right, so that was your point. Now, let's see if you can remember this. Does it contain all the resources that the process program needs to execute? Which resource doesn't it have? Exactly. And that's the topic of chapter 4 and the next two lectures. So there does not have the CPU. And we'll discuss that in greater detail when we talk about threads. This is the essential point. Processes are bags of resources that enable a program to execute. Did we talk about anything else? In the previous lecture, I'm trying to think. Probably not. I mean, we talked about what does a process look like? I mean, if I asked you to draw a picture like I drew in the previous lecture describing processes, how would you describe that picture? What does a process look like from the picture, the way I drew the picture? And this is actually kind of an important point because it's focusing on a particular resource in the bag and using that as kind of a synecdoche to represent the entire process in terms of one of its pieces. So how would you characterize the picture of the processes that I drew in the previous lecture? If I asked you to draw a process, what would you do?
Input, output, CPU.
I don't remember that picture. Maybe I drew that, but that is actually not the picture I had in mind. It's not clear where the process is in that picture either. Right, but where's the process? So I have a CPU and input and output, and I have lines, but where's the process in that picture? Well, no, it can't, because we just said a process does not include the CPU. Well, here you have it in there. So if I drew this like this or some other way, then this is not a good representation of a process. No, again, the process does not include the CPU. If you're going to draw a picture of the process, it cannot include the CPU. Well, registers are part of the CPU. Yes, but how did I draw that picture? There's like a two-word description you can use to describe the process. This is the picture I'm thinking of. Remember that picture? So here's the process. And so how would you characterize it? Yeah, program and data, but just even simpler? Exactly. That's why I want something even simpler. So we don't even get into these quibbles. Chunk of primary store. A process is a continuous sequence of primary store, right? That's an extremely abstract point of view because it's only focusing on one resource in that bag, which is the primary store associated with that process for execution. This is all we're going to need to talk about processes tonight. So this will be our view of process, a continuous chunk of primary store. There's other stuff involved, but we don't have to be concerned about that. And when we get to memory management, we're going to make this picture really more complicated. But that's down the road, so we don't have to worry about that yet. So what are we going to talk about tonight? So that's what we talked about. Let's see. Anything else? I believe that's about all we need to talk about from last time. So, all right. What we're going to talk about tonight is interprocess communication, which is abbreviated, usually, IPC. And the interesting, well, there's a number of interesting things about interprocess communication. With respect to the notion of designing and building operating systems, one of the most interesting is it is a direct representation of the kinds of conflicts that are going to have to be resolved by an operating system in providing resources. And in this case, the two conflicts are essentially, let's see, how do I want to say this? The two conflicts are related to security versus function. As we'll see, there are lots of different useful functions that you can provide to users in user space if you have some form of interprocess communication. And so these are the kinds of things that users would like to be able to do. Exactly, right. When you talk about independent processes, you're emphasizing security. When you talk about cooperative processes, you're emphasizing function. Okay, but in order to do that, in some sense, to provide one, you have to reduce the other. So if you want to provide security or independence of processes, then you have to reduce function. But if you want to provide function, as you would when you want cooperating processes, then you would have to reduce security. All right, so that, again, that's the nature of the trade-off, but that's another way to look at it. Independence versus cooperation. And you want to provide both of these. There are times when you just want a program that runs and doesn't talk to any other program, although, as we will discover in a minute, that's not possible. And then there are other times when you want to have a raft of programs, and we mentioned some examples, like, for example, word processing, right? You might want to do word processing, but you also might want to do spell checking, formatting, all kinds of things. Automatic citation lookup, really great things like that. And those can be written as one big program, but in fact, it might be better to write them as independent programs that are cooperating with one another. And we will look at some facilities that will provide that in tonight's lecture. So this is one of the interesting points here, is this trade-off. And we're going to see this over and over again, right? You can do this, but then it costs you that, and if you do that, then it's going to cost you this. And one of the interesting tasks in operating system design and implementation is to come up with that trade-off. Actually, the best thing you can do is get rid of that trade-off. That's one of the reasons why microkernels are so interesting, because it gets rid of a lot of those trade-offs. Okay, they no longer become trade-offs because they don't exist anymore. Now, some people would correctly argue that, well, you know, you're not really getting rid of them. You're just pushing them off to somebody else. And that's correct. But that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, as long as you're not that other person. Right? That's somebody else's problem. Now, the first thing we have to do is figure out, well, I mean, why do we even want IPC? Because, and I think we talked about this last lecture too, when I drew my picture, I had one process and I was going to talk to. Are there any other processes that are running if this is my one process? So this is like a really typical single process job. It prints paychecks, for example, since that's something I've been dealing with recently. It prints paychecks, right? It just runs, give me the input data, tell me where the printer is, leave me alone. Does it really need to talk? Is there any other programs, processes running around here? Does it really need to talk to any other process? Are there any other processes it can talk to? Careful, this is a trap. The disk. It's hardware. But follow that further. Follow that thought further. Is there any other process around other than my little check printing process? No, it just prints them. Somebody else comes along and does all that other stuff. Somebody else is... Exactly, there you go. That's the advantage there. Come on, the answer is, of course there is. What is it? The operating system, exactly. Remember, earlier we identified the operating system as just another program. And, of course, it's executing. So it's a program in execution. Therefore, it has resources. Now, those are special kind of resources. In fact, it has all the resources. But still, the same principle still applies. So we, in fact, even when you only have one process running, you actually have two. You have the process itself and the operating system. So this idea that we're doing inter-process communication is always relevant, even when you only ever have one process, because there is always the operating system as a separate process. Is that enough? That doesn't actually make my point, right? Why? A perfectly valid observation to this is, so what? Why is this an interesting observation? Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a trivial observation. Maybe it has no meaning whatsoever. Why is this interesting? The fact that we have, with my check printing process, this operating system that's also executing. Why is that a non-trivial observation as opposed to a trivial one? Again, what's the topic of discussion for tonight's lecture? We'll get to that, but that is... At this point, because we're talking about IPC, we pretty much cast our lot with function. Right? So security is our enemy, not our friend here. From that point of view, we're interested in function as opposed to security. You're right, it's always there, like a bad odor, but we are interested in function for the moment. Why is this not a trivial observation, the fact that we have a process running, my check printing process, for example, and an operating system? If I just make that observation, that's a trivial observation, but in fact it's not. And what's the issue that makes it non-trivial? And again, remember the context in which we are having this discussion. The context is inter-process communication. So this observation about the existence of the operating system is trivial if there's no communication between the process and the operating system. Then you could just say, so what? So the question is there communication going on between the process and the operating system? If there is, then we have a non-trivial observation, and then we can pursue the question, well, what does that look like? But if there's not, then we can go on to the next topic. Yes, that's true. That's true. But presumably that is done before the process is actually executed. Right? So as you're finding out, something has to bring that program associated with the process in from the disk. The operating system does that. And the operating system also kicks off the process execution. And of course, at the back end, when the process is done, then the operating system has to recover the resources, and I just answered the question for you, by the way, and also has to, you know, say, okay, this is free, and now I can bring in the next product. So there is communication, but that's kind of a trivial form of communication before the process lives and after the process dies, right? The question is, what happens in between those two points? Is there any communication in between when the process starts executing and the process ends? Exactly, yes, and that goes back to your question about the disk. Where does the disk come from? Well, the process has to ask the operating system for access to the disk. So there is, in fact, communication going on between the process and the operating system, and also in the opposite direction. For example, you can imagine things like saying, oh, this process should only run for like 10 seconds. There's really no reason for it to run more than that. We have high-speed laser printers. We have big, fat disks. So we should be able to print checks for everybody within 5 seconds. Right? So if the process is running for more than 10 seconds, something's wrong. Kill that process. That's a form of communication back into the process. Right? But principally, most of the communication is going to go from the process into the operating system. Right? So there is IPC going on, even if we only have a single process. Okay, and that IPC, anybody know what that is? You all should know. It's from your reading. You're also doing it in your assignment, although you're only doing it once. You're going to be doing it a lot more in your second assignment. The form of the communication between the operating system and the process is? For the most part, there are a couple of different forms, but we'll just look at the principal one. Somebody said system call. Yes, exactly. System call. And this will be the first of our IPC mechanisms we'll talk about. All right, so let's look at this. What needs to be done? Well, let's take our check printing example. There is the check printer, and let's move back from the disk. And again, we can use abstraction here, and let's just say the check printer needs a file of earned salary, weekly earned or biweekly or monthly earned salary. So it will request from the operating system access to that file of earned salary, and it's going to use some kind of mechanism that looks a lot like a procedure call. So it's going to do something like open. And, of course, there are other things that we can put in here, for example, permissions, modes, blah, 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 but we won't worry about that because they don't change anything significant. And what it gets back is some indication of success or failure. So I'll just call that SF. And if the request has succeeded, then it contains a file ref. Okay, a reference to that open file that it can then read, presumably, since it opened it with read access, let's assume. All right, everybody should be familiar with this, except for this sort of weird notation, but that's not really that weird. All right, anybody have any questions about this? I mean, now the question, sorry.
What does that say in parentheses?
Earned income. Just file name. You call it a file name if you want. This is the file name. Or, you know, maybe it's an SQL, whatever they call SQL things. What do they call them? Queries. Thank you. You know, maybe it's something like that. Anything that produces a sequence of data that needs to be read. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Actually, maybe it does matter because the database is slightly different. So let's stick with files. Now the question is, what does this look like? And in order to understand that, let's again take a look at what this is. Now what we can do is sort of break this apart. I have two processes. And let's just take the operating system as a sort of regular process. It's a special process for the reasons we've discussed. But let's just assume it's a regular process like any other process, which is more or less the truth. What is the difficulty in casting the access from P in the form of a subroutine call? Does that make sense? Are we like done? Have we provided the ability for the operating system to provide this resource to the process using this function, let's say? Is there anything, and the answer is yes, is there anything that is preventing us from implementing this as a function call? Well, yeah, let's assume that's taken care of. Let's assume that this is a valid open call in the sense that all the information that needs to be supplied is supplied and supplied correctly. So that's not an issue. The question I'm asking is, given that we have two processes here, independently executing processes, right, how does this work? How does an open call here translate into some activity over here? And then, of course, there's the community. So there's sort of like this picture. We pass the arguments this way, and we get the results back, if we think of it in terms of procedure calls. How does this work? There should be something that suggests that this is perhaps not quite as simple as I'm presenting it to you. What is that thing? What is the difficulty that you have when you actually try and implement the open in this way? Okay, what in particular? What kind of layer of protection are we talking about? Are we dealing with here? What is the layer of protection that we're dealing with here? It is the process boundary. Remember when I told you about the kinds of state that go into a process, one of the things that you have is the high bound and the low bound. It's the continuous range. So essentially that means that it isn't impossible for this process to issue an address request that goes outside the bounds of this process. Which kind of suggests that this approach is not going to work. And of course there's also, well, and here's where the idea that the operating system is just another process kind of falls apart, because you also have that difficulty going the other direction. If the operating system was just another process, then you would also have the difficulty of moving the results from here to there. Because any reference to something outside the bounds of this operating system would cause a memory error, as you're going to find out in your second programming assignment. You didn't have to worry about it for the first one. You will have to worry about it for the second one. All right? So this idea that this is a function call, right, and can be somehow implemented that way is not going to work because we have these protection boundaries around the processes, these fences. I like to think of them as fences that essentially say you can't access anything outside that fence. All right, and any other process cannot access anything inside another process's fence. So there are hard limits here. And of course, because this is the operating system, it's even worse, because there's even stronger protections within on this side of the operating system. So the question is, how do we do it? How do we do IPC using this model? Which, of course, this is the model you use, right? You issue open requests. This is the model you use. How does it work? What is the mechanism that you use? The mechanism that you use is the context switch. So what happens is, what looks like an open call, in fact, translates into a bunch of storage values, a bunch of storing of values, parameters into locations. So you have some sort of location. L1 gets parameter 1, L2 gets parameter 2, and so on up to LN gets parameter N. Okay, and then you have a couple of other parameters, LN plus 1, which again you should understand from your exit, your implementation of the exit call, followed by some instruction, which I will call a trap. Okay, and it is this magic that essentially allows the process, one process to communicate with another. Sorry, I should be more precise. That allows the process to communicate with the operating system. All right, so this is the mechanism. This is what this kind of call turns into. It turns into a system call. This is what's known as a system call, which we identified somewhere. I guess we didn't. All right, so I'll identify it here. It's a system call, and that turns into something which creates a context switch. And what happens is this causes an interrupt to be raised in the operating system. And this does a number of things. Among the things it does, it raises the level at which the code is executing from, depending upon the protection environment, but usually there's two, from user space mode into kernel mode. If you program on Intel systems, they're called rings. This is ring 0, and this is usually ring 3. Same thing. The difference between these two is the ability to access the resources in the hardware, in the architecture. Here, the user has limited access, and here, there is unlimited. And the idea behind the rings were you had various levels of access as you moved down the rings, right? So at the outermost ring, you had the smallest amount of access, and then as you moved inwards, you had access to more and more resources until you got to the center, ring 0, where you had access to everything. So the context switch flip not only allows you to go from one process to another, but it also changes the environment within which the resulting process executes, in this case the operating system. This is going to be the only time that occurs. The other IPC mechanisms that we're going to talk about tonight do not have this change of mode, but the system calls do because they have this context switch. And this is the reason why we incur an expense, because we are crossing a protection boundary from unlimited access from limited access to unlimited access. And of course, we're going to do that in the opposite direction to go back to provide the answers. We are going to go from unlimited to limited. That is going to be another context switch, but in that case, we are not going to be doing any interrupts there. At least not directly related to returning back to the process that executes. Yes?
Limited user what?
User space mode. And kernel mode. You can just call it user mode if you want, but user space mode is a little bit more descriptive. Yes. Exactly. One of the, so in LN plus 1, what you would store there is some code associated with open. And this actually gets translated into this sequence of instructions, which, of course, is a little bit different from the sequence of instructions that you would get if you were actually making a function call. This is pretty much the same, except maybe they go on the stack or something. And then down here, well, you wouldn't have this. You would have not a trap, but just a regular JSR, jump subroutine, or whatever. Okay, but here you have a special instruction that causes an interrupt that transfers control out of the calling process into the operating system. And this is done on every system call. That's how you identify a system call, when it essentially transfers from the process into the operating system. And then, of course, what the operating system does, again, as you're finding out, is it picks up, it looks into, now this is the operating system, right? It is all powerful. It has the ability, and this is the other reason why this abstraction isn't a very good one, this process has, in fact, the ability to go into this process and muck around. Right? So, in fact, what will happen is, the trap will come into the operating system. The operating system will handle the interrupt, get the information it needs from the PC, for example, as well as the other registers in the CPU, figure out which process it was that sent this request, and then start rummaging around this process's address space for this information. It assembles that information into something, which we'll talk about when we talk about device I.O., and then essentially issues the appropriate device commands to cause this request to be satisfied by whatever device you're looking at, whether it's a disk or a database or whatever. And then, of course, a lot of other things happen, which we'll talk about when we talk about scheduling and blah, blah, blah. But eventually, that request, and again, we'll assume success here, gets satisfied, and then the operating system gets another interrupt saying it's done. We were just talking about this earlier. You were asking about disk I.O. So that gets satisfied, and you essentially do the reverse. The operating system stores values into locations, which are associated with the parameters and the return values, through magic, which we will not discuss because we don't need to. And then essentially flips back, completes another context switch back into the process that was running. So what looks like a relatively simple open call, function call, in fact is fairly complicated. And that's part of the magic of operating systems. It looks and behaves just like a function call, but it's pretty easy to tell that it's not, because it is much more expensive than a regular function call is. If you do something really simple, which you think would be trivial, like, for example, what time is it? Right? That's a system call. You have to go into the operating system, read the clock, and come back out. Well, if you measure that, you're going to find it takes orders of magnitude more than it does to make a simple function call from one part of your process to another. And the question is, why is it like 1,000 times more expensive? And the answer is, you're making a system call, and you're crossing these protection boundaries in two directions. Even though you're doing something trivial on the other side, like reading the clock and returning the value, you still have the cost associated with passing these protection boundaries. Again, this should be familiar to you from your work on the first programming assignment. You only have one system call to write, which is the exit system call, which is kind of an odd one, because it occurs at the end of the process lifetime, so you don't actually return from it, which is a little weird. The other system calls that you'll implement in your second programming assignment and later programming assignments are more like this behavior, where you essentially make a call, do some stuff, return some results. But same principle. So that's our first IPC mechanism, and it's a little strange. It is an IPC mechanism, I would argue, because you are, in fact, going between two processes, one of which is sort of weird, like a super process in some sense. But, again, it is just a program operating with a set of resources. So, yeah, it's a process. All right, but that was kind of cheap, right? I mean, sure, the operating system's always there, and if you are executing another process, well, you got two processes, you can do IPC. So let's forget the operating system now. Well, we can't forget it, of course, because that's what the course is about. But let's assume now that we're going to concentrate on having more than one process executing. All right, and the first question we have to ask is, does that make any sense? Multiprocessing, is that a thing or what? Is there any reason to have more than one process executing at a time? So another way to ask this question is, do multiple processes make sense? And now, and this is actually, I don't know who brought it up, was it you? The notion of independence versus cooperation becomes kind of important in answering this question. So first, let's just ask the question about whether or not it makes any sense. Okay, so if we take the point of view we're interested in cooperation, then the answer appears to be yes. Can you give me like one word or a phrase that will condense all of what you said into... Okay, so I categorize that as simple design. And I believe we talked about this when we talked about word processing, right? You have a word processor and you like to do all these things like spell check, WYSIWYG, and so forth and so on. And there's a number of different ways you can do that. One way you can cram them all into one piece of code, right? So one process. Right? And some people do that. That's like Word does that, for example. Right? One honking big program. The other approach to take is to break out the separate functional pieces into independent processes, right? So you have one process that does the data entry, in a sense. It reads in the information from the user and provides some sort of rudimentary display. So you have the I.O. part. Well, let me say interaction part. And then you have some other part that does spell check. And then you have another part that's responsible for doing WYSIWYG. Does everybody know what WYSIWYG is? What you see is what you get. It is a style of document processing in which what you look at is an exact, let us assume, representation of what you would get if you printed your document. Right? Word is WYSIWYG. Oh, exactly. Yes, there are also, I guess, WYSIWYG HTML and JavaScript and CSS editors, so that when you make changes, they show up automatically. Same thing. Same principle. And you combine those. Of course, these things have to communicate with one another, right? Because the words are coming in here, and then they're being checked here, and there's results being displayed back maybe here. For example, green wavy lines or red wavy lines or whatever. All right, so there's IPC going on here. This seems like a justification for multiple processes, and also determines some characteristics that we would like to see on our IPC mechanism. It should be able to support this kind of behavior. Any other justifications for multiple processes? We have simplified design or flexibility or whatever you'd like. Anything else? And this one is actually a little bit more traditional, and I believe I called it concurrent speedup. This is a word processor which contains the same functions as this word. So these are both word processors. Here's one word processor. Here's another one. And they both do the same thing. They both have the same set of functions. Spell checking, WYSIWYG, whatever. Automatic reference lookup. In this case, each one of those functions is broken out into a separate process, right? So this is a multi-process structure. Where this case, same functions, but everything is included in the same process. Right. So this does spell checking, this does WYSIWYG editing, this does automatic reference lookup, so forth and so on. But it's all in the same big process. This should actually look familiar because we talk about this is monolithic operating system architecture, and this is sort of modular or microkernel or other kinds of smaller, more functional approaches to design. And, you know, this may be acceptable. This may be an appropriate solution to a particular set of characteristics. But generally speaking, no. But the other important aspect approach to doing multiprocessing is concurrent speedup. And by this, I mean I have a process, and let's assume it's a standard, well, let's take our check writing process, right? What has to happen? Well, it's a loop, and we could just speculate. So it reads a record from the file, which essentially contains one person's earnings for the, let's assume it's a biweekly pay period. There are some calculations that go on here with that references. So, for example, you need to compute withholding of various kinds. You need to compute, I don't know what else you compute. I haven't had a paycheck. Well, actually, I don't look at my paychecks anymore. But, whatever it is you need to compute in order to do this, you need to look at some federal databases to figure out how much of this stuff you're computing belongs to the federal government, how much of it belongs to the state government. If you're in New York, how much of it belongs to the city government, how much of it belongs to FICA, so on and so forth. And then when you get all that figured out, you eventually send it out to the printer. You have all the data, you print the check and the stub that goes with it. So that happens in a loop. But let's look at this. This is not very efficient, because what happens? This is going out to an extremely slow device. Let's assume it's a disk. So this is going to take a really long time. This isn't going to take very much time. It's just a couple of simple calculations. Maybe a table lookup or two, but we have that cached in memory someplace, so that's not very slow. And then we're going to go out to a slower device. Not as perhaps slow as... Well, yeah, probably as slow. In fact, even slower, because it's dealing with even the less precise mechanical parts, the printer. You're talking about a laser printer, that's true, but you're also talking about sheets of paper. Or maybe it's a continuous feed, but even there it's pretty slow. So you have two slow things in between a fast thing. So there's fairly clearly an imbalance here. What you would like to do is you would like to do as many of the slow things as you can at a time. And then you can do the fast things in between. So what you would actually like to do is break this up into three pieces, where essentially you have the first piece that does all the reading. That is the most efficient way to use the disk, is just to continuously drive the disk, reading the data. It's still going to be slow, but it's going to be the least amount of slow that you can. And then you're going to get all these calculations, which you can do all at once because you have all the data, and then you can just blow them out to the printer, and you're done. You can stop now, because once the printer gets all the data, it just gets formatted and sent out to the printer. So what's the speed of this? If I were to ask you, what is the speed of this particular piece of code, you would say, just back of the envelope.
Over one.
It's not constant time. Even a simpler characterization of the speed. Yeah, but why is it slow? Quantify that. It's the sum of the individual activities. Right, multiplied by the number of times you do them. So what we're looking at here, this is a sequential piece of code. You incur the cost of doing this, then that. Right, that's the cost. What's the cost here? Quantify that. What does it mean by a lot faster? It is in fact linear, but why is it linear? Actually, yeah, linear. Let me say that. Well, this is linear too. So they're both linear. Exactly. So that means the slowest. What's the speed of this?
Slow, fast, slow.
Exactly. The speed of this is the slowest of the three components. Right? Here, the speed is the sum of the three components, including the slowest. Here, the speed is the slowest or the maximum of the three components, which means you leave out the other two. You're doing the other two essentially in the shadow of the slowest, and let's assume that's the read. So we have reduced the cost of printing the checks to the cost of doing the read, as opposed to the cost of doing the read, followed by the calculation, followed by the print. And everybody said, well, I don't want to spend too much more time on it because this is not a design class, but this gives us concurrent speed up. This is the other major justification for considering multiprocessing. So the answer to the question is yes, multiprocessing makes excellent sense. Great, it's justified. Let's figure out how we can do it. Again, we have the same problem that we had with the operating system, except this time, this is just a regular process. So rather than being an operating system, it's just some other process. So we still have the question, how do we communicate? How do we do these arrows? How do we provide these arrows? This is the form of inter-process communication. This is another service provided by the operating system. So we have essentially two paths to IPC, two mechanisms. We should probably be more technical about that, not paths. That's too metaphorical. Sorry about that. Two mechanisms for IPC. The first one is called shared store, and the second is called message passing. Whenever you have two ways of doing something, you should immediately if you want to be moderately on the ball, one of the things you should be thinking to yourself is, huh, what is the difference between those two mechanisms? Which one is the more powerful of the two mechanisms? So looking at shared store and message processing, one of the things you might want to be thinking about as we go along in the lecture is, which one is more powerful, shared storage or message passing? This is a favorite test question of mine, but since we're not having tests in this class, I can use it here. And one of the difficulties that students have is understanding what I mean by power. And essentially power, when you ask about whether something is powerful or not, you're asking, is there something that one of those mechanisms can do that the other mechanisms cannot? Right. And if that's the case, then the first mechanism is more powerful than the second because the first mechanism can do something that the second one cannot. Of course, that's kind of a simplified point of view, and it's easy to imagine circumstances where those two things conflict with one another. But for now, we'll just ignore those possibilities. So one of the things you might want to be thinking about is, huh, well, what does that mean in terms of power? Is there something that one of them can do that the other one can't? Now, before we answer that question, we need some criteria with which to judge the suitability or the capabilities of a particular IPC mechanism. And I'm just going to do this really quickly because you can read a little bit more detail about it in the book. The three that they identify in the text: speed, capability, and flexibility. All right, and these are the pretty obvious ones. Speed can be measured in a number of different ways, but the reason that speed is important, apart from the general thing that we always want to be fast, is, remember, what we're doing here is we're crossing protection boundaries, which is, again, going to be slow. So the important question is, how slow is it? And that's why speed is important. And, of course, faster is always better. Capability is pretty much all the other requirements other than speed. So, for example, how much data can you send? Are you limited by the amount of data you can ship from one process to another? For example, if you are writing a word processor in this structure, can I just send the document from the front end, the I/O part, to the word processor part? Or do I have to chop the document up into 5, 12, or 1K byte chunks and send them individually? Again, that's an example of capability. And then finally, flexibility. Another way to think about flexibility, I think the textbook uses flexibility, is adaptation to change. Okay? One of the really interesting things you can do with modern operating system design, whenever we introduce a wire between two things, what can you do with that wire that's really, really interesting? And people do this all the time. You can replace it with a network. Right, I have a wire to the disk. Well, what happens when you replace that wire with a network? Bang, you have storage area network. You have essentially your disk on the network, which means that anybody can access it, which is good and bad. Right, so essentially by replacing wires with networks, you can send your operating system, first of all, break it up into pieces, and then send it all over the place, all over the world. That's an example of flexibility. The question is, if you use a particular IPC mechanism, what happens when you do that? What happens when you send your disk over to Cupertino, right, where Apple is? Where I assume, well, I don't know, that's naive to assume that they have their, iCloud stuff in Cupertino, but what the hell, why not? Could be. What happens when you use one of these mechanisms and that happens? Does it fall apart? Does it just shrug and say, that's not a problem, I can deal with it? So that's an example of flexibility or adaptability to change. So these are the three criteria that we're going to use. Or Seattle, and actually no, AWS is all over the place, so never mind. Okay, so first we're going to look at shared storage. And in one sense, from one point of view, shared store is in the more natural of the two mechanisms. All right, so I'll just introduce that concept and then I'll justify it as we go along. So let's take a look. Let's just take two processes. And let's assume that this is the reader process for our check printing program. And this is the calc process. Now, let's use an extremely powerful design technique, which is known as wishful thinking. What would we like to be able to do to send data from here to here, which is what we want to do? What is the easiest possible way for us to do that? That's what we'd like to figure out. Any suggestions? And again, we're using wishful thinking here. So you can be as impractical or as ridiculous as you want. Right, and the question is, how would you do that? What would you like to see that's what you want to do? Just tell me how to do that now. So somehow we'd like to magically have the ability for this process to look into this process and see what's going on. If we do that, then it's clear we can communicate between the two, right? Right, we would like to share resources. And in particular, what resource do we want to share? Storage, exactly. So what we would like to have is we would like to have some magic block of storage that, in fact, appears in both. So we'd like to have some magic block of storage such that any change in the storage here magically shows up over here. And vice versa, but we're not really interested in going in the other direction. But that's possible too. So essentially this is a magic block of storage that appears in the same place in both processes. So that's the odd thing, is that we have something that is in two different places at the same time. That turns out to be possible. And we'll discover how to do that when we go to the storage management section later on in the semester. But for now, we'll just assume that it is, in fact, possible. All right. So does everyone see how this answers the problem of providing inter-process communication? How would the check writing program use this storage? How does IPC go using this mechanism? Read essentially reads the data from wherever into this block of store, and any change written into this block of store magically shows up here. Calc will then read that data, do the calculations, and continue on. And of course, it also works in the opposite direction if there's communication. And in fact, there has to be communication in the opposite direction. Anybody want to give me the argument why very quickly? That's true, but there's a more fundamental reason that any process will need to have, any two processes that communicate this way would need to communicate back. And your example is correct for this, but I want an answer that's correct for any configuration of processes. And we'll talk about it again later on in the semester. I think it's like lecture number section 5, synchronization, coordination. How does Calc know that the reader is done writing? Right? Because it takes a finite amount of time to write the data into this block. So how does Calc know that it should start reading? Because in fact, the reader could be much slower than Calc is. So in fact, Calc could be reading a record, half of which is new data and half of which is old data. Okay, so there needs to be coordination and synchronization going on, and that has to be true for any use of this kind of shared store. Exactly, that's the concurrent speed up. They are executing in parallel as opposed to sitting around and waiting for read and then going on and doing calc. And you can begin to see why this is the more natural mechanism, because it is using nothing more than you would use to write any other section of storage in this process. There is no difference writing this block than there is writing any other region of storage. So that's why it is, in some sense, more natural. It has a very strange behavior, but that doesn't affect the way you fundamentally interact with the shared storage. And this is, as the name suggests, the idea of shared store IPC. Right. Now, it's natural, because the actual communication is done using standard storage read and write instructions. So there's nothing special that needs to be done once it's set up. You just do reads and writes on it, and boom, you have this inter-process communication. It's unnatural in the sense that you have to set it up. And essentially, it depends on how the operating system provides it, but you need to have at least four kinds of mechanisms to provide this. So you need to have something like allocation, which is usually called in the shared store lingo, attach. So you would have something like shared memory attach. And again, the parameters may vary, but you need some way to identify which particular region of shared store you're interested in. And you probably need things like size and maybe something like mode and maybe some other criteria like access list, who has the ability to access this. If you attach something, then you... Wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. I hope you didn't write down attach, because this is going to be... I'm going to change this, not to attach, but to create or something like that, except I want to make sure... Make. So you need to make a segment. Or allocate. Since I said allocate, let me just write down allocate. Natural, standard rewrite instructions. No special instructions. You're just using the same instructions to read and write the shared segment as any other segment in your address space, in your process address space. Each process then, so the creating process or the allocating process has access to this chunk, and now other processes need to get access to it. So they would use SM attach, and they would have to specify a matching ID so the operating system knows what segment they're talking about. They also might want to specify a mode. For example, the reader process may create this shared store to be writable by everyone, but the calculator only needs to read the data, so there's no reason for it to have write access, so it may specify read-only mode, okay? And then there may be other issues that you want to deal with, but the principal one is which piece of memory do you attach to. That will essentially do this mapping. So this is make, will give you this mapping, and then any other processes subject to constraints based on the allocator can do the attach to bring that piece of store into its address space and have access to it. And then you just want to undo these. So you have SM detach, and that's just, again, ID, which would break this connection. And then you have SM deallocate, which gets rid of everything. And that's it. That's shared store. The nice thing about this is these are system calls, right? You have to go into the operating system to do it. But these are only done, in a sense, at the beginning and at the end of communication. So the cost of doing that, you're not really concerned about. Once you have attached or allocated a segment of shared store, everything else is done in user space. So there's no protection boundary crossings going on, even here between the two processes, right? Because in a sense, I lied to you earlier when I said, oh, the protection boundaries are inviolate, right? Here is one way to violate the protection boundaries. So with respect to this security versus function, we have a highly functional communication mechanism, but there really isn't any security here. So this is all pretty fast, and the implementation details of this will have to wait until we get to memory storage, memory management, storage management. But that's it. That's it for shared store. Any questions about that? Now we can go on to the second. So speed is very fast if we ignore the stuff at the edges. It's essentially memory speeds. A little bit slower, but we'll just say memory speeds. Capabilities, well, pretty much you have the capabilities of whatever the store is. So essentially it's wide open. Flexibility, now here is where the problem comes in, right? Because, wow, I now, you know, suppose I want to put these on two different systems. Now we got a problem. So this is less flexible in terms of, for example, spreading things out over a network. But that's fine. The second approach to doing IPC is message passing. So let's suppose that you're some sort of security officer in a company, you look at this and what do you say? You're a security officer and some people want to do something with shared memory or shared storage, and what do you say? Sorry? Exactly. You say, oh, no, 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 no. You cannot violate these protection boundaries. You must maintain protection boundaries. Who knows what information could leak? And in this case, they actually know what they're talking about. Right. So this is, in fact, a problem. So we need some way to provide IPC that, in fact, does respect these protection boundaries. So again, going to our wishful thinking design technique, what do we want to have? What would be a way to respect protection boundaries and yet still do transfer of information across processes? Again, using wishful thinking. The question is, I want to communicate between processes, but I want to also respect the protection boundaries, which this does not do. How do I do it? No, the issue is we're okay with transferring information. Although you're right, this is a problem. Let us assume that it is okay for the two processes to view that information. So we don't have to worry about encryption or anything like that. Now, you might want to worry about it, but let's assume we're not. What we want to do is we want to figure out how to get the information from one process to the other and still respect the protection boundaries, which this does not do. And the answer is, well, you wrap your information up in a piece of paper and then you throw it at the other process. Okay? So one process has some data, for example, a buffer full of earnings information. So it wraps it up in some piece of paper or something and then throws it over to this other, so this is the reader process and this is the calculator process. It throws it over to the calculator process. The calculator process somehow catches it and then unwraps it and then does the calculations.
It's like package sharing.
Sorry?
It's like package sharing.
Exactly. Except that's kind of networky, so we'll just do it. But yeah, you're right. You got the idea. Now, this, of course, respects the protection boundary because essentially this process says, I'm just, you know, getting rid of this. I'm not doing anything. And this process is saying, well, I'm just catching this. Everything is hunky-dory there. So now the question is, how do we actually implement that? Does everybody understand what the mechanism is here? Right, packets, messages, yes. Yes, well, actually, we probably are not going to have any time, but that's exactly, you can do that. That's correct. Yes. Ah, we will talk about that. But you understand the basic mechanism we're talking. Yeah, apparently you do, given the nature of your question. All right, so this is what we want to do. Now, it turns out there are three characteristics that we're interested in doing. The first one is, how do I figure out where to throw it? Okay, and also, at the receiving end, how do I figure out who is throwing this rock? Because it may not be the case that a particular process wants to catch a rock thrown by any other process. I may, for example, only want to catch... For example, the calc should only catch rocks thrown by the reader. Yes, but what's the nature of that? So that's the first, is naming. How do you name things? So what I'm giving you is the three axes of the design space for message passing. Okay, the first one is naming. The second one is synchrony. And then the third one is buffer size. Okay, and I have 5 minutes to do it. All right. Essentially, there are two choices in naming. The first one is the processes themselves can be named. Okay, so essentially, you would have a function called send, not spelled with an F, and it contains a rock, or more technically, a message. And it also contains the name of the process that should receive that message. On the other side, you have the receive, which accepts a message and also names the sender of that message from which it is willing to accept messages. Oh, I guess this should... Well, it stands for process, but I should probably make it a little bit... The receiver process and the sender process. So I am sending a message, and in fact, your second programming assignment, you are going to be writing a send that will send to any willing receiver. Okay, so that's an alternative way to deal with this. It's called publish-subscribe, for those of you that are familiar with it. And then on the receiving side, the receiver can say, I only receive rocks from a particular process, or if it's a server, for example, it will receive rocks from any process, so it would have some sort of wild card like star or whatever. Okay, so that's the first, and that's what's known as explicit naming. Explicit naming has the unfortunate property of being unflexible for lots of different reasons, which we don't have time to go into. In fact, we probably don't have any time whatsoever, so let me just continue on. The next thing we have to figure out is synchrony. Thinking in terms of throwing and catching is a good way to do that, because there's a certain synchrony between thrower and catcher, right? But that doesn't necessarily have to be true. What happens if the thrower throws a rock that the catcher is not ready to receive? Which is quite possible, right? Because these processes are executing independently. The calculator could be off doing something like waiting for the latest IRS data to come in on the new tax structure because of the APC. Wait a minute, did I get that right? ACA, the American Care Act. Right. So if the calculator is talking to the federal government and the reader is trying to throw rocks at it, what happens in that case? That's the issue behind synchrony. Similarly, we can go in the opposite direction. The calculator is hungry for data. It's got a full laser printer. Right? Everything's ready. But what's the reader doing? The reader is not sending anything. So what does the calculator do? What happens then? How does the calculator handle that? That is the question of synchrony. And essentially, there are two answers to that question. One, a very important answer, which, you know, it's like this will be the last thing I'll say in this lecture. Blocking or non-blocking. So one obvious answer is they wait. If a sender wants to send data that the receiver is not ready to receive, then the sender just waits until the receiver is ready. Vice versa, if the receiver is ready to get data from the sender that the sender is not ready to send, the receiver just waits. So that's what's known as blocking I.O. or blocking message passing. And, of course, the alternative, non-blocking, which is the receiver gets an error message saying that the sender is not ready or there's nothing to receive. And that's it. We will pick this up on Thursday. Any questions?